I can't listen anymore to how she sacrificed her ability to be an artist so that I could be one, he said. It sucks. Conversely, her joy in cooking has completely transferred. It is central to the way I think about everything. Bunny stands at a slight remove from Nico's triumphs. People say, congratulations, Nico is such a success, she said. I didn't do any of it. But the task that Frank and I should be congratulated for is that he's a person who knows how to be happy. He chooses a controlled melancholy, but he has alternatives. Nico is generous with his personal biography, but fiercely protective of his soul. It's an ostentation of privacy. In early English church music, there are many screens between you and the heart of the matter, Nico said. With Benjamin Britten's music, even if it's really exuberant, there's always this kind of obliqueness. But you can see the beating heart, the relic. The popular line on Nico Muhly is that he appears joyful but is actually sorrowful, that the beating heart is sad and the screens in front of it are lovely. That reduces him terribly. He has integrated the emotional spectrum so we can hear joy and sorrow both at once, but he never averages them. You may reach into his joy and pull out a surprising handful of sorrow, but when you examine that sorrow, you find it suffused with particles of joy. Correcting a bias against genius is a social responsibility, in part because most accomplishments are contingent on a social context. In some ways, this is the ultimate horizontal identity. A man with a natural aptitude for skiing, who is born into poverty in Guatemala, will most likely never discover it. Someone whose primary talent is as a computer programmer would not have gone far in the 15th century. How would Leonardo have busied himself if he'd been born an Inuit? Would Galileo have advanced string theory if he'd been around in the 1990s? Ideally, a genius should have not only the necessary tools and conditions to realize his gifts, but also a receptive society of peers and admirers. As Alfred Kroeber noted in the 1940s, genius sparks genius. If I have seen further, Sir Isaac Newton acknowledged, it is by standing on ye shoulders of giants. Like sainthood, genius is a label that cannot properly be affixed until considerable time and a few miracles have ensued. We help the disabled in a quest to make a more humane and better world. We might approach brilliance in the same spirit. Pity impedes the dignity of disabled people. Resentment is a parallel obstacle for people with enormous talent. The pity and the resentment alike are manifestations of our fear of people who are radically different. Juilliard president Joseph Palisi observed that devotion to classical music is predicated on an acquired way of listening. As American pop culture became a global juggernaut in the late 20th century, and multiculturalism became the key word on nonprofit grant applications, the perceived elitism of classical and experimental music eroded its audience at an alarming rate. It has been fashionable to dismiss classical and experimental music as exclusionary, which is a semantic argument. No one prevents the non-elite from entering classical music's hallowed halls, but such music is an acquired taste, based largely on European aristocratic and liturgical traditions, and more affluent people are more likely to be comfortable and familiar with those traditions. The profound question is whether it is worth the effort. Lucretius defined the sublime as the art of exchanging easier for more difficult pleasures, and almost 2,000 years ago, Schopenhauer proclaimed that the opposite of suffering is boredom. Classical music, which may look dull to the uninitiated, contains complexities that can make it electrifying for those who study it. With a myriad of perceived flaws, people have learned to find meaning in difficulty. And while the challenges of deafness or Down syndrome may overshadow the rigors of learning to like Prokofiev, the quest for meaning via exertion is not altogether dissimilar. In both cases, earned pleasures supersede passive ones. Better services for people with disabilities and disadvantages allow them to function better, and thereby pay for themselves manifold. Educating the gifted is likewise in the public interest. If we credit scientific and cultural advances to this identity group, refusing them acknowledgement and support is costly to the population at large. We live in an anti-intellectual society in which people of extraordinary achievement are as likely to be considered freaks as to be lauded as heroes. Margaret Mead observed in 1954, "There is in America today an appalling waste of first-rate talents. Neither teachers, the parents of other children, nor the child's peers will tolerate the wunderkind." Voters want the president to be someone with whom they would feel comfortable having a beer, rather than a singular leader with attributes they lack. Celebrities' talent is minimized soon after it has brought them to prominence. This phenomenon, which serves no useful end, is part of what the social critic Rhonda Garalick has called the crisis in admiration. I was struck by how many former prodigies who were critical of their own upbringings found themselves struggling with how to raise their own talented children. Candy Baucom's daughter, almost 16 when I interviewed Candy, has perfect pitch, plays the piano, and studies voice. When Katie first started piano at 3, I wanted to be extremely regimented, Candy said. It has to be 3:30 every day, and we're going to do it this way. It caused tremendous friction. I had to just let all of that go. I wondered why. Candy, who had been careful not to criticize her own mother, answered, "Because I didn't want her to blame me, someday, for a life that she didn't want." Nick Hodges has found himself similarly conflicted. "It would be very ungrateful to say that being given a piano lesson at 6 is really pressure," he said. "I'm a musician, which wouldn't have happened if my mother hadn't been the way she was. I can't imagine being, or even wanting to be, anyone or anything else." Now he finds himself facing the quandaries of parenthood. If you invest your whole life in a family business, you want your children to carry on investing in it, Nick said. You want them to be artists who know everything you know and can benefit from everything that you've experienced. All parents want that, and it never works. Jeffrey Kahane's father grew up in immigrant poverty, 9 people living in 2 rooms. He became a highly regarded psychologist and was determined that his son traverse a similar distance. Jeffrey was frequently expected to perform at home. "I found real solace and joy in the piano, but it was tainted. I didn't want my love for music to be sucked up to feed my father's incredible need." Jeffrey met a girl named Martha at a summer camp when they were 10. They wrote long letters, promising to marry young and have 2 kids. And they did. Martha was a music major at Berkeley, and eventually became a psychotherapist. Jeffrey became a widely esteemed pianist and conductor. Their son, Gabriel, was born in 1981. Martha noticed that he sang completely in tune at 2. At 4, he asked her, "Do you hear the jazzy sound that train is making?" His talent, however, was not nourished with discipline, and his violin teacher eventually said that there was no point going on. "My mom was the disciplinarian, and my dad, who was performing and gone a lot, stayed very much removed from my musical upbringing," Gabriel recalled. They both had the right approach, and they both had the wrong approach. Gabriel's musical influences were varied. He listened to rap CDs by Dr. Dre and Cypress Hill and House of Pain. But he also loved his parents' music. Paul Simon's Graceland, Joni Mitchell's Blue, The Beatles. He took up jazz piano, sang in a choir, became involved in musical theater. When he wanted to learn something, he learned it. The speed with which he learned to play the piano in his teen years was mind-boggling, Martha said. But schoolwork didn't hold Gabriel's interest, which worried Martha constantly and worried Jeffrey not at all. I thought he should do his homework, Martha said. Jeff didn't really believe in the educational system. I remember Jeff said to me, Gabe is a huge talent. I sort of got it, but I didn't get it like Jeff did. Gabriel flunked out of high school. It was mortifying to have this brilliant kid not graduate, Martha said. Does the fact that I felt that make me a pushy parent? Gabriel dropped in at the New England Conservatory of Music, took an ear training test, and was accepted immediately. By the end of a year, though, he found it parochial. He was dating a young woman who went to Brown. He applied there and was accepted. My hubris was helpful, he said. I wrote some persuasive essay about why I was a fuck-up at school. At Brown, he became attached to the idea of accomplishing something that would outlive him. Being a creative rather than an interpretive artist was a way of dealing with the death drive, he said. He began composing, and his first musical won a prize from the Kennedy Center. When Gabriel graduated, he moved to New York and began what would become the Craigslist Leader, a song cycle that took online personal ads as a libretto, which he premiered in 2006. He would perform the songs in a dirty bar on a banged-up piano for a bunch of hipster kids from Brooklyn who knew nothing about classical music, he said, and they would go crazy. But his work also appealed to classical musicians. In 2007, Natasha Peremski commissioned his first sonata. In 2008, he released an eponymous album and received a commission from the Los Angeles Philharmonic. I attended Gabriel's debut concert with jazz at Lincoln Center. Even when the work was vaguely classical in mood, and even when it was performed with a dozen other musicians, his centrality to it made it feel incredibly intimate. He told me that he had to write his music to his own strengths, because there was so much he couldn't do. I asked whether he regretted those gaps in his musical education. He said, in every instance that I have witnessed someone whose childhood involved the push, there's arrested development, or there's a poisoned relationship to the art, and I just don't think it's worth it. My father and I have a deeply unambivalent relationship, and if there's any way in which I continue to try to be like him, it's in his appetite for knowledge as the basis and the foundation of why we do what we do. His father wanted more than anything else not to replicate with his prodigious son the relationship he'd had with his own controlling parent. I bent so far backward to be disengaged from Gabe's successes that I went overboard, Jeff said. Gabe said to me, I wish you had made me practice more. I can't help thinking, though, that being allowed to find his own path resulted in a very unusual artistic presence. Martha said, Gabe is such a kind person, and that's in his music. He's told me sometimes he thinks about the way I respond to music when he's writing, and he's thanked me for giving him that emotional honesty. Gabriel has recorded or performed with pop musicians Rufus Wainwright, My Brightest Diamond, and Sufjan Stevens, as well as with classical stars such as cellist Alisa Weilerstein and baritone Thomas Kwasthoff. The New York Times called Gabriel a highbrow polymath. He told me that he would like to reach a unified language. He explained, the idea of being a genre-bending performer is tired, but I feel increasingly oppressed at the concert hall, I hate the institution's reactionary elitism, its lack of irony. In the classical world, people don't understand that Lennon and McCartney had as savvy a sense of harmony and melody as Schubert. What few adults can do, even fewer children can do. In the grand scheme, however, genius is only marginally more astonishing than development itself. Small children go from nonverbal to verbal in 2 years, and to literate in 5 more. They can master several languages at the same time. They learn how the shapes of letters relate to both sound and meaning. They grasp the abstract idea of numbers and the means by which numbers characterize everything around us. They ace all this while they are learning to walk, chew, perhaps throw a ball, perhaps develop a sense of humor. Parents of prodigies are intimidated and awestruck at what their children can do. But so, fittingly, are parents of children who are not prodigies. Remembering that is the surest way to remain sane when parenting a child whose skills dramatically differ from or radically exceed one's own. All parents of prodigies are making an enormous investment in a dubious outcome with high risks: forsaken social development, crippling disappointment, chronic relocation, even permanent family rifts, all in the hope of an elusive lifestyle that may not be what the grown-up version of the prodigy turns out to want. While some parents push their kids too hard and give them breakdowns, others fail to support a child's passion for his own gift and deprive him of the only life that he would have enjoyed. You can err in either direction. The pushing error is more obvious and more present in our culture, but the other can be equally dire. Given the lack of consensus about how to raise ordinary children, it is unsurprising that none exists about how to raise remarkable children, and many parents of prodigies are flummoxed by children whose internal measure of happiness is radically alien. Goethe's mother described telling stories to him. Air, fire, water, and earth I presented to him as beautiful princesses, and everything in all nature took on a deeper meaning. We invented roads between stars, and what great minds we would encounter. He devoured me with his eyes, and if the fate of one of his favorites did not go as he wished, this I could see from the anger in his face, or his efforts not to break out in tears. Occasionally he interfered by saying, "Mother, the princess will not marry the miserable tailor, even if he slays the giant," at which I stopped and postponed the catastrophe until the next evening. So my imagination was often replaced by his. And when the following morning I arranged fate according to his suggestions and said, "You guessed it, that's how it came out," he was all excited, and one could see his heart beating. That one phrase, "my imagination was often replaced by his," bespeaks all that is most beautiful in the parenting of a remarkable child. In so replacing one's own imagination, one facilitates the growth of the child's. For the parents of prodigies, such wise self-effacement may exact a high price, but those who can set their own path by the light of their child's brilliance may find great solace in the ways that child remakes the world. Chapter 9. Rape. A child conceived in rape gets as rough a start as a child with dwarfism or Down syndrome. The pregnancy is usually greeted as a calamity, upending family life that may already be riddled with strife. The mother not only doubts her ability to meet the challenges of child-rearing, but is also uncertain whether she will ever get over the very fact of the child's existence. rarely is a reliable partner on the scene to help. All new mothers are prone to ambivalence, but the hostility and revulsion often experienced by the mother of a rape-conceived child may be reinforced by her family. Society is likely to judge both mother and child unkindly. With most disabilities, those who do not share a given condition struggle to find the humanity within it, while those who do share the condition gravitate toward one another for support, validation, and collective identity. With children of rape, however, the flaw is indiscernible to strangers, sometimes to family and friends, and often to the child, who must cope with its psychological shadow nonetheless. His horizontal identity is both profound and oblique. Often his identity is a family secret, much as adoption can be, and who tells what, when, and to whom becomes a loaded give and take. You can keep your child's deafness or genius or autism secret only for a short time. Others are sure to notice. The child himself will usually notice. Children conceived in rape may go a lifetime without knowing their own identity. This means that who the mother is in the child's eyes and who the child is in the mother's are often in flux. Unlike adoption, however, which many experts believe should be shared with adopted children even before they can understand its fuller meaning, rape is too confusing and frightening to explain to a toddler. It's terrifying for any child to envision his parent as vulnerable, much less to feel complicit in that vulnerability. Horizontal identities usually originate in the child, then spill over to the parents. Children conceived in rape, however, acquire their horizontal identity by way of their mother's trauma. Here, the children are secondary, and they are much less likely to find others of similar exceptionality with whom to solidify that identity. The mother has the stronger horizontal identity, and the child has a resultant existential aloneness that follows from it. The mother of a schizophrenic may find herself in a club she never meant to join, but that association is defined by her child. The mother of a child conceived in rape has her own, separate, primary damage to negotiate. Her identity as a mother proceeds directly from her identity as a rape victim. Her child embodies the violence done against her and gives manifest permanence to what she may ache to forget. Instead of being unhinged by a startling discovery about her child, she knows what is wrong even before she learns that she's pregnant. Soon thereafter, like many other mothers of exceptional children, she must figure out whether she can love a child who is antithetical to anything she imagined or wanted. Many people see children of rape as intrinsically defective, including, often, their own mothers. Unlike other factions so perceived, this one has not coalesced into a thriving identity group. There is no obvious way to celebrate the part of oneself rejected by others. Even once a child knows his or her origins, he or she cannot easily locate others who share this identity. It is difficult to reckon with a visible disability, and at least equally so to reckon with the defining difference that remains hidden. One of the few organizations founded to address this vacuum, Stigma Inc., took as its motto, "Rape survivors are the victims. Their children are the forgotten victims." Historically, rape has been seen less as a violation of a woman than as a theft from a husband or father to whom that woman belonged, who suffered an insult and an economic loss. A woman's marriageability spoiled, for example. Hammurabi's code described most rape victims as adulterers. 1,000 years later, the Athenian state, prioritizing the protection of bloodlines, treated rape and adultery the same way. English law of the 17th century took a similar position. Classical mythology abounds with rape, often by a licentious god. Zeus took Europa and Leda, Dionysus raped Aura, Poseidon, Aethra, Apollo, Euadne. It is noteworthy that every one of these rapes produces children, and that rather than being avatars of shame, they are half-immortal. The rape of a Vestal Virgin by Mars produced Romulus and Remus, the twins who founded Rome. Romulus later organized the rape of the Sabine women to populate his new city. In the Renaissance, representations of that event often decorated marriage chests. Yet the hostility such children's origins may inspire has also long been acknowledged. In ancient and medieval societies, women who bore children conceived in rape were permitted to let them die of exposure. Misogyny is amply present in writings about rape throughout history. The great Roman physician Galen claimed that women could not conceive in rape, nor otherwise without an orgasm based in pleasure and consent. While Augustine promised women that savage lust perpetuated against them will be punished, he also noted that rape keeps women humble, whether previously they were arrogant with regard to their virginity, or overfond of praise, or whether they would have become proud had they not suffered violation. A woman in the American colonies could not make a claim of rape. Her husband, her father, or, if she was a servant, her employer, needed to present the cause to a magistrate. The understanding was that women were prone to bringing such charges to disguise illicit consensual sex. These women were considered guilty unless they could prove their innocence. In Puritan Massachusetts, a woman pregnant through rape was prosecuted for fornication. These habits of blaming the women began to change only with the social justice movements of the early 19th century. The Kingston British Whig noted in 1835, "The bad character of a woman ought to be no reason that she should be without the protection of the law." Rape of black women in the United States was not acknowledged as rape. You could not violate your own property, and children conceived through such rapes were themselves slaves. Black men accused of rape were frequently found guilty, if not killed without trial. White men often made cash settlements with their white victims to avoid prosecution. In the 1800s, the court's primary concern was protecting white men who might be falsely accused. To prosecute for rape, a woman had to demonstrate that she had resisted, usually by showing evidence of bodily harm, and to somehow prove that the man had ejaculated inside her. Rape remained underreported through the mid-20th century because women feared adverse consequences if they spoke out. One impregnated rape victim of the 1950s said, "If a certain male wanted to get out of being named the true father, he would get about five of his buddies to swear they had sex with the girl." Branded promiscuous, the female had little recourse against the fellow, and she already experienced shame galore for birthing a child out of marriage. The rise of psychoanalysis did not help matters. Though Freud wrote little about rape, his followers saw the rapist as someone suffering a perverse, uncontrolled sexual appetite who fed into women's natural masochism. As late as 1971, the criminologist Menachem Amir described how women have a universal desire to be violently possessed and aggressively handled by men, and concluded, "The victim is always the cause of the crime." Appalled, feminists of the 1970s began arguing that rape was an act of violence and aggression, not sexuality. Susan Brown Miller's 1975 landmark book, Against Our Will, Men, Women, and Rape, maintained that rape had little to do with desire and everything to do with domination. She proposed that rape occurred much more widely than acknowledged, a result of the power differential between men and women, and she called for gender-free, non-activity-specific laws that would purge rape of its sexual content to moot the idea that both parties were implicated. American law had defined rape as an act of sexual intercourse undertaken by a man with a woman, not his wife, against her will, and by force. Feminists attacked this definition, broadening it to include non-consensual sex within relationships and marriages, extending it to include involuntary sexual contact other than penetrative penile-vaginal intercourse, removing the burden of proving that the encounter had been caused by irresistible force, and eliminating gender specificity. The new view of rape encompassed sexual predation by a known assailant, and coerced contact even after consenting words had been spoken. Michel Foucault famously said of all sexual relations, "There is no difference in principle between sticking one's fist into someone's face or one's penis into their sex." A punch in the face is violence that employs the mechanisms of violence. Rape is violence that tarnishes the apparatus of love. Rape violates the intimate private self as well as the outer social one. It is neither purely sexual nor purely violent. It is the humiliating expression of a power differential that aggressively unites these two motives and behaviors. Both medical professionals and law enforcement officers are now widely trained to respond to evidence of rape. Legal definitions still vary from state to state and do not always accord with those used by the FBI and other federal agencies. Definitions vary even more widely internationally, and many countries classify forced sodomy as a much less serious crime than forced vaginal penetration. Because my focus is on women who bring up children conceived in rape, I did not speak to men, children, and postmenopausal women who have been raped. But no one is immune to rape's humiliating expression of a power differential. As other social awareness movements have transformed the experience of rearing a child with a disability, so feminism has changed the experience of rearing a child conceived in rape. The idea of a proud victim would have seemed laughable only a few decades ago. Like all injury and abnormality, to be raped was ignominious. Because the crime was so rarely acknowledged or discussed, it was seldom prosecuted. Feminist definitions of rape have sought to quash the suggestion of victim culpability. Terms such as sexual assault and criminal sexual conduct address the primacy of violence and change our understanding of rape from something a woman experiences to something a man does. Despite these enormous strides, rape often remains invisible. Our warnings to our daughters caution them against getting into a car with a stranger, or going home with a man they meet in a bar. But 80% of rapes are committed by someone the victim knows. More than half of rape victims in the United States are under 18, and nearly a quarter of them, an eighth of the total, are under 12. Rape is often habitual in abusive relationships and violent marriages. Impoverished women who depend on men for survival feel less volition over their own bodies. The Centers for Disease Control have asserted that rape is one of the most underreported crimes and estimate that only 10 to 20% of sexual assaults are reported. There is not much writing about keeping children of rape, and the books that do exist mainly address genocidal conflicts abroad or are packaged in anti-choice invective. The women I interviewed were eager to tell their stories in the hope that doing so might help others. It was painfully apparent, though, that they did so at considerable cost. Many would agree to meet only in extremely public situations because they felt they could not trust me enough to be in a more secluded location together. Others insisted on extremely private locations because the subject was so loaded that they couldn't bear to speak of it where someone else might overhear them. Marina James assured me that her neighborhood library in Baltimore was a good, quiet spot to talk. But when we got there, it was closed. It was a raw March day, but Marina guided us to a bench in a public park, where other people could see us but not hear us. At 26, she punctuated her most shocking thoughts with the word, obviously, and seemed to believe that anyone else of even moderate intelligence would have made the same decision she did. Marina had gone to Antioch College in 2000. A lot of their philosophy is striving for the best and doing good for others, Marina explained. These were always things that I held important. After freshman year, she took time off to live in New York with a boyfriend, became pregnant, and had an abortion that destroyed the relationship. Then she returned to Antioch. At a campus party, when she was 20, the student DJ slipped a disabling sedative into her drink and then violently raped her. It's more of a physical memory than an intellectual memory, she said. I don't have pictures in my head, but I have feelings in my body. She didn't press charges. I know what defense attorneys do to rape victims, she said. I drank, I did drugs, I had a good time. What justice would I get? It seemed like so much grief for nothing. When she talked about her experience to other women at the college, however, some confided that they'd been raped by the same man. None of them wanted to press charges either, but they provided written statements that Marina presented to the dean, and the rapist was expelled. Because she didn't go to the police, Marina feels tragically culpable for the rape she imagines him to have committed since. When Marina learned that she was pregnant, she assumed she would have another abortion. But in her third month, she changed her mind. She didn't want to go through the process again. She would have the baby, then give it up for adoption. But as the months passed, she became disillusioned about adoption. She had used recreational drugs just before finding out that she was pregnant, and an adoption administrator told her not to say as much on the form because it might put off prospective parents. The deceit upset her. The middleman was the only one benefiting, and all the people who had something at stake were being toyed with, she said. My child was going to be biracial, and all the families were white and liked the fact that I was a well-educated white girl. The construction of her racial identity was going to be important, and I didn't think any of these people could help her with it. So Marina decided to keep the baby. Now that I have Amula, and I have been really successful at being her mom, obviously I know I made the right decision. But at the time, I didn't know that. So it was torture. Marina gave birth later that year and chose the name, derived from amulet, because she wanted the baby to be a sign of good luck and a protection against the evil that had produced her. Marina was paralyzed with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, perhaps mixed with postpartum depression. I felt like I was a different person, and I couldn't even remember what the old person was, she said. Marina went on to graduate school in social work, bringing her daughter to classes, but began to have frequent nightmares and had difficulty eating as well as sleeping. Amula started daycare and saw other children dropped off and picked up by their fathers. Before she was two, she was asking, "Why don't I have a daddy?" It made Marina cry, and she didn't want to cry in front of her daughter, so she started getting counseling. But they kept wanting me to talk about the rape, she said. Everybody wants a play-by-play. I don't want to keep reliving a half hour of my life. I have all this other life that I would rather live. At 26, Marina is an idealist who lives to almost ostentatiously high standards, as if determined to outflank weakness and self-indulgence. She is attractive, poised, and somewhat severe. She talks about her own vulnerability easily, but she does not demonstrate it. It is hard to guess to what degree she was always like this, and in what measure being raped reshaped her. Like many of the women I met who had borne children through rape, Marina James sustained both revulsion at the origin of her pregnancy and profound joy in her child. I thank God every day that I have my child, but I can't ignore the fact that it's a very painful thing why she's here. She didn't tell her mother about the rape until after Amula was born. Nonetheless, she and Amula moved to Baltimore because Marina's parents lived there and could help with childcare. That's where Amula is right now, obviously, she said. Marina's older sister, Nina, moved in with Marina and Amula. My sister was like a mom to me since my mom was so absent, and now I'm like a mom to my sister because she prefers to regress, Marina explained. I tell Amula, you don't have a dad, but we have Aunt Nini. A lot of my Antioch friends are gay, and so I tell her lots of kids have two mommies or two daddies. I try to be proactive about how I frame it. Marina eventually promised Amula that she would look for a daddy for her, but shows little interest in having a partner herself. I don't consider myself a sexual person, she said. I was before all this. I feel sad that Amula does not have a father, but not for me. Of course, Amula does have a father in the biological sense, and Marina knows his name. Protecting her from him is the best thing I could do for her. My friends keep saying, you have to be able to forgive him in order to accept it and move on. I want to punch people when they say that. Although the rape and its aftermath tested Marina's belief, she has increasingly turned to God in a quest for greater insight. She was Christian, but her childhood friends were all Jewish, and after she returned to Baltimore, she reconnected with them and began to convert. Studying Judaism has enabled me to feel emotion, which I haven't felt in years, she said. It's enabled me to feel hope and to feel faith, and it's definitely helped me to feel better. It's my way to not retreat from the world. As a social worker, Marina frequently has to grapple with stories of sexual violence. My personal pain is just a ripple in this huge ocean of pain that women feel every day, she said. Teaching other women about parenting makes it even more meaningful for me to come home and give my kid a big hug and sit down and play with her on the floor. Not just to enjoy it, but to be validated in knowing what a good job I am doing. Marina has told her boss and several colleagues about Amula's origins. People ask me, and I don't like to lie, she said. It makes people uncomfortable. For someone who deplores lying, it's all the more difficult to field Amula's increasingly complex and urgent questions. Marina says she doesn't feel ashamed, but remains concerned about how Amula would incorporate the rape into her own identity. I just want her to know that she is always wanted, that I chose to keep her, and feel that it was the right choice. Even when I was struggling every day with being a survivor, I never thought, I wish I didn't have this baby. When Marina is with Amula, she isn't remembering the rape. I'm thinking, oh, are your clothes clean for swimming tomorrow? I'm being a mom. It's when I'm in bed at night that that stuff comes up. Marina said she related to veterans returning from Iraq. They've seen horrific things that they could never express. They come home and they don't know how to use their bodies. They're different. Nobody understands. And they return to a community that has all these expectations that no longer make sense. That is exactly how I feel. She surmises that having a baby soon after the rape may have curtailed her recovery. I had to be a survivor and hit the ground running and take care of this kid, she said. But she admitted that without Amula, her method of recovery would simply have been to try to forget what had happened. And then at some point later, she said, it would have exploded. She worries that her bright, charming daughter might share personality traits with her rapist. Half of her genes are evil, Marina said. I can do whatever I should as her mom to make her this loving, wonderful, caring person. But in her is the DNA of a person who is really sick. And is that DNA stronger than what I can do? There is a war of statistics about the correlation of rape and pregnancy, and the confusion is only exacerbated by the adversarial agendas of the pro-choice and anti-abortion movements. Some have argued that the biochemistry of fear promotes ovulation, concluding that 1 in 10 coitally raped women gets pregnant. Others have produced estimates as low as 3%. Women suffering ongoing abuse are particularly likely to conceive through that abuse, though violent abuse can cause damage, sometimes permanently, to a woman's reproductive capacity. Of course, pregnancy does not ensue when the victim is not of reproductive age, is using oral birth control or IUDs, or is a man. It is also precluded by non-vaginal rape. Studies have found that between 25,000 and 32,000 rape-related pregnancies occur each year in the United States. In a 1996 study of rape-related pregnancy, half of the subjects terminated their pregnancies. Of the rest, two-thirds kept the children, one-fourth miscarried, and the rest gave the children up for adoption. Extrapolating from those figures, at least 8,000 women in this country keep rape-conceived children every year. Ready access to a safe abortion allows a woman who keeps a child conceived in rape to feel that she is making a decision rather than having the decision forced upon her. Even opponents of reproductive choice often allow for a rape exception. Raped women require unfettered independence in this arena. To abort or carry to term, to keep the child or give him up for adoption. Women who opt to raise such children, like parents of disabled children, choose the child over his or her challenging identity. They and their children may struggle with societal condemnation. Many women keep children conceived in rape because they have no access to abortion, because of religious beliefs, or because of a controlling partner, husband, or parent. I also met women who completed their pregnancies because deep self-examination led them to that decision. I met women who described keeping their pregnancies as a mute reenactment of the forced passivity they had experienced in rape. Some said their children felt like evidence, as if to abort them would be a denial of the event that produced them. Because the option to terminate any pregnancy is strongly associated with feminism, many of these women found their only support in the anti-abortion movement and got saddled with a moral discourse to which they did not necessarily subscribe. Many women who wished to keep children conceived in rape said they felt intense social pressure to abort. Pregnancy following rape is a double crisis. Pregnancy after rape implies the nightmare not only of remembering the assault, but also of giving it life inside her being, said Ana Milena Gill, a psychologist working in Bogota, Colombia. By violating her body as a place of identity and autonomy, pregnancy resulting from rape creates a circle of pain. If rape hurts, damages, breaks women, pregnancy traps them. Living with the violence in your womb means having the attacker inside you. An infant conceived in rape unites the genetics of the mother with those of her assailant. For some women, the rape-engendered fetus represents the unwelcome conquest of her body by an alien being. For others, it seems to be an extension of herself. In an article in U.S. News and World Report, one otherwise anti-abortion woman counsels her sister pregnant through rape, "If someone shot you, would you walk around with a bullet inside of you?" But another woman in identical circumstances said, "The baby was innocent, a victim like I was." It is imperative to remove a bullet from your person. It is likewise essential not to deprive an innocent child of life. The language used in these contexts implies moral values. The anti-abortionist feminist Joan Kemp writes, "It is significant that a child conceived in rape is more often called the rapist's child than the rape victim's child. In what sense can a rapist possibly be considered the father of this child?" Language can be spun to dictate the reasonable course of action. A woman raped by a military guard is said by Kemp to have concluded that the child was hers, that to reject the baby was to succumb to patriarchal attitudes. In this framing, the figurative bullet lodged in the mother is transformed into her center of power. Some women experience attachment and revulsion in rapid alternation. In other instances, an initial hatred can give way to love, sometimes when the movement of the fetus is first felt, sometimes not until the child has matured into an adult. Women who have grown to love such children are often outspoken critics of abortion. Kay Zabolski, founder of the Anti-Abortion Life After Assault League, explained of her own pregnancy at 16, "The baby was part of my healing process. When she started to move in me, I looked at her as part of me, not him." Similarly, Kathleen DeZeu tried to deny that she had become pregnant following her attack, wearing girdles to conceal the changes in her body and attempting to self-induce miscarriage. "But once the fetus began to kick and move," she said, "I began to realize that this little life inside me was struggling too. Somehow, my heart changed. I was no longer thinking of the baby as the rapist's." Sharon Bailey said, "Basically my feelings were, it's just you and me, kid. I considered us both to be victims." Knowing that your child had no part in violating you, however, is different from feeling that your child is untainted. "The first time I held him," Kathleen DeZeu admitted, "I was instantly reminded of his conception. There were many times that I had terrible feelings of hatred toward him. The laughter of my little boy often reminded me of the hideous laughter of this guy as he had raped me. I took it out on my son." Another woman reported despairingly, "I had tried to convince myself that the rape never happened. Then I would look at her and realize, yes, it must have happened." Padmasayi Papaneni, who has studied women pregnant through rape, wrote, "Rape survivors have a much greater fear about intimacy, less comfort with closeness, and more fear of abandonment. Feelings of rejection by the mother toward the infant can lead to a wide range of psychological consequences in the child. The children constantly reminded mothers of the horrors of rape, and that inevitably influenced mutual relations." One August day in 1975, Brenda Henriquez left her home in the projects in Queens to pick up her paycheck for working as an urban summer camp counselor. She had tied the front tails of her shirt to show off her tanned belly in defiance of her mother, Lourdes. She got off the subway and was passing a parked cab when its door swung open and a man pulled her inside. It was just so fast. I was on the floor. There was that hump in the middle of the car floor, so my butt was up on the hump, and my face was down on the floor. The driver came into the back seat, and the two men raped her in sequence, then handed her jeans to her and pushed her back into the street with blood running down her legs. Back home, she took a long shower and didn't say a word about what had happened. Mom warned me about my shirt, and I didn't listen, and look what happened, she said. So I blamed myself. I felt like everybody knew. It was like I had a sign on me, not a virgin anymore, or rape victim, asked for it. When she missed her first period, she told her best friend, and they snuck out during recess and went to Planned Parenthood for a pregnancy test. When she called in for the result later and found it was positive, she collapsed in the phone booth, crying. At the time, abortion was legal for a 16-year-old without parental consent, but she didn't think that an abortion would be a lie I could get away with. She told her boyfriend first, and he said he never wanted to see her again. Then she broke the news to her parents. Her father, Vicente, said, "Are you sure that's what happened? Why didn't you go to the police?" Years later, she shuddered. Why? The whys came, she said. I said, "Mommy, I was wearing the shirt you told me not to wear." And my mother says, "You could be standing there naked on that corner, and no one would ever have a right to do that." I cried with relief. Still, they wanted to keep the pregnancy secret. Her Catholic father wanted her to go to stay with relatives in Puerto Rico and give the baby for adoption. Her grandmother told everybody that Brenda had secretly been married and her husband was in the military. The High School of Performing Arts wanted her to withdraw from classes. One of her friends circulated a petition, after which the school administration backed down, but moved her to a less visible place in the orchestra. Brenda felt she had to be her baby's champion. Brenda gave birth the last week of her junior year. She wanted to name her daughter after her paternal grandmother, but her father said, "I don't want my mother's name on that baby." She said, "I wanted her to have a crowning name that she wouldn't be ashamed of. I went through the Bible, and Rebecca means captivating. And that just clicked." When Brenda's father saw the baby, he had a change of heart and wrote Brenda a card that said, "Thank you for giving me my first granddaughter." Brenda slid into a postpartum depression. "Partly, I guess it was biology," she said, "but partly it was that all my friends were off having a fun summer vacation, and I was home with this baby." Her family doctor encouraged her to seek counseling. Even with a woman psychiatrist, it took Brenda a couple of months to describe the rape itself, upon which the therapist asked, "At any point, did it feel good? Did you enjoy it?" Brenda walked out and has never seen a therapist again. Vicente was a car mechanic, and Lourdes was a nurse. Brenda's ambition was to be a doctor, but with an infant at home, she couldn't reach so far. "So I volunteered for the ambulance corps," she said. "I would go into the training class dragging my daughter and put her in one of those little portable playpens, and that's how I got my EMT. Brenda loved working the ambulance and eventually became a qualified paramedic. I asked Brenda whether her anger at the rapists had ever coalesced around Rebecca. "Never that," she said. I look at her, I see me. I don't see the other person at all. I wasn't going to take her life away before she was born, and I sure as hell wasn't going to take her life away afterwards. But she was trying to